What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you are tuned in to Kinda Neat. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, as always. My new thing is skipping the social media, so we're going to get right past that. This interview was long, and it's long because it is with one of my personal, like, rap heroes. Man, when I was a kid, the Grouch and the Living Legends in general were just, like, everything to me as, like, an 18, 19, 20-year-old. Just starting, like, to see what they built when I was younger as independent hip-hop musicians, it convinced me that it was possible to do this. So I'm a huge fan, and so to get to kind of, like, fan out and have a fucking two-hour conversation with this dude, I'm not gonna lie, like, I don't fan out on the show often, but it's like a dream come true. So it was really dope for me, and you know, some of my best, like, show memories from that time of my life between, like, 18 and 20 something are at Living Legends shows, or at shows where Grouch would just pop up, or later on, like, opening for the Living Legends. I've gotten to play shows with them on more than one occasion, and I'm just grateful for all the music he's putting out, or put out over the years, and just how kind of cool he's always been. So yeah, I was stoked to do this interview. I'm not going to do, like, a super long intro. I'm just going to say that if you are a fan of underground hip-hop and the hustle, this is a really cool history lesson on one of the most important guys to do that. So, with that being said, here is my interview with the Grouch. How do you stay busy these days?
How do I stay busy?
Yeah.
See, to me, having one daughter and just trying to live a regular life, it takes up all my time. You know, that's why I don't, that's why I'm in awe of this guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, right. Yeah.
One daughter is enough for me.
Right.
You know, to take up all, like, that could take up all my time just in that. Just
right.
In trying to hang out with her, get her to school, make her lunch, make sure we eat a good dinner, make sure we go do something fun after school. You know what I mean? I have a hard time trying to fit music in between that.
Yeah.
And I don't. You know, I'm a slow, like, I need time to do things. I need time to cook a dinner. I need time to write a song. I'm not someone who could just go bang, 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 bang on everything, you know?
That's interesting. I gotta say, like, just from what you present on social media and stuff like that over the years, I've always just been kind of impressed on how you've built a pretty fucking normal life, like,
yeah.
And like an awesome life. And I mean, first and foremost, congrats on being able to, like, build a career and a life off of your passion for so long. That's rad.
Thank you,
and I'm
bro.
Sure you don't get to hear that. I'm sure you're happy, and perhaps it's nice to just take a second and look back and go, oh wow, I did this.
Yeah,
that's dope.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, for certain. First and foremost, I want to, like, find out kind of where or how that life got built. So, like, we'll go way back and just start with, like, where were you born at?
I was born in Oakland, California.
Oakland, California. And how long did you stay in Oakland?
Yeah, old Oakland, because Oakland now is a different place.
Yeah.
But I stayed in Oakland till I was 22 years old.
Oh, so, like, you're Oakland native.
Born and raised.
Yeah. How'd your folks end up there?
My mother... Man, you know what? I need to go ask some stories.
I always try to dig up the past here, you know what I mean?
That's crazy. Wow. You know, I think my mom was born in the Bay Area. I don't even know.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
Right.
I should ask her that.
So you got generations there, perhaps.
Yeah, but she's... I know that she did some time in Arkansas.
Really?
And then, yeah. And then my father, I know he was from... Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
For sure. He was a musician in the Bay Area.
Kind of music did he play?
He used to play blues and, like, you know, jazz, blues, funk kind of stuff.
Guitar?
He played the piano.
Oh, sick.
Yeah.
You said he passed?
He passed.
How old were you when that happened?
That was in 2003, I believe.
Oh, you were grown up at that point.
Yeah,
but yeah,
that's
terrible. How did he pass?
He passed skin cancer.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, thanks.
What was he like?
He didn't raise me. He was a musician.
Okay.
He was like a, you know, he played with a bunch of people like Eddie Money and Huey Lewis like who else? Like what's that dude? I forgot his name.
Wait, was he on the Back to the Future song then?
No, he was not on the Back to the Future song. He like played with some guys who made it, but he never really made it like
that. Yeah, but he led the traveling blues musician life.
Yeah, he was like a Bay Area independent musician dude.
Just a generation before.
Yeah, a generation before. But he never really figured out how to like carve his own niche. You know what I mean? He kind of played with these guys. He had he did have a following. There's sometimes like somebody came up to me the other night with his records for me to sign at my show
like
in San Francisco. No, actually it was a fan of his who like figured out that I was his son.
Oh, wow.
And so he came to the show and brought his records and everything. Wow. And that
how did that feel?
That felt great.
Yeah.
It was cool.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it was cool.
How often would you see him as a kid?
Him and my mom kind of had this deal where it was like, all right, you're not, you know, you're off the hook.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And my mom remarried. And so I just see him every once in a while, like Christmas vacation. Sometimes they would do like his side of the family would go do like a rental in Tahoe. And then I would show up over there and hang out with his side of the family. But
yeah.
I always felt like I wasn't really a complete part of that.
Like a bit of an outsider at those events.
Yeah. You know, he just had this, you know, he was doing his musician life and then he married another woman and they had a family.
Yeah.
And, you know, he kind of had this agreement with my mom. I don't know. My mom kind of just hooked it up to where she just took full responsibility. And
right.
I don't know. I kind of have some mixed feelings about it, but I kind of understand. But it's not how I would have done things.
Right. You know? I was going to say, you seem to be such a strong family man. Did that kind of inspire that?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
I always hear that, like, people maybe with, like, dads who weren't particularly there, they try even harder to be a good dad or something, you know?
I feel like that's the most important thing is for me to be there for my daughter.
Right.
Always, forever. Right. You know what I mean? Regardless.
So mom remarried at what age?
She had to be...
Oh, no, like, how old were you?
How old was I?
Yeah, sorry.
I was, like, 5.
Oh, okay. So that's, like, stepdad was, like, there.
Kind of. He's a good dude. He was an alcoholic back then.
Yeah.
They had 3 kids together, you know, constant kind of fighting and stuff and with him and my mom, and it wasn't pretty.
Did they stay together for a while, though?
They stayed together for a while, but off and on, here and there. And then my mom finally got it together to where she was like, I'm not going to accept this anymore.
And then got rid of him?
Yeah, got rid of him. And then it was mostly single mother to 4 kids.
Wow. How did she support the family?
She's a teacher.
Oh, my mom's a teacher, too.
Your mom's a teacher?
Yeah, for sure.
So she just, I don't know. She always held it down, and she always... You know, her kids were the first thing for her, you know, the most important priority.
How were you when all that was going on? Did you rebel? Were you a feisty little kid?
Yeah, I was kind of like, I mean, I was into hip hop, though. That's
from a very early age.
From a very early age. I was growing up in Oakland. I remember I was listening to this radio station, K-Poo, and it was an independent radio station out of San Francisco, I think. And they used to play Too Short, of course.
Of course.
And they also played, you know, the East Coast version of that, which was at the time, LL Cool J, Run DMC.
Right.
You know, I found Boogie Down Productions on that. And so, yeah, I got into hip hop as a young kid.
Like, how young do you think?
I don't remember how young.
Yeah.
Because actually, even those artists don't add up in the dates.
You know,
'cause Too Short, I don't think.
He came out a little later than Run DMC.
Yeah,
right.
You know what I'm saying? So,
we're part of that first generation, though, where like rap was already alive when we were alive. And so it's kind of like if you're born in the early 80s, late 70s, whatever, you don't remember hearing your first rap song because it was just already on the radio, you know?
Yeah, I remember hearing the stuff that was going towards rap on the radio.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what those songs were called. But yeah, I, you know, 9 or 10.
So when you took an interest to it, did you immediately be like, "Oh, I want to participate in this"?
Definitely not.
Yeah,
yeah, I didn't think so. I just loved music. I loved rap, and I didn't get that until I started getting into junior high, and you know, high school, maybe right. first year of high right. school or something. And I got that feeling that I could actually participate in it because there were some guys around me who were writing raps. And then when I saw Hieroglyphics at school, because I went to the same school with those guys,
really,
is when it really blew my wig. And I was like, oh, shit, this guy that I sit in history class with is on BET right now.
Wow.
So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
So as like a 5-6-year-old starting elementary school, you got a alcoholic stepfather at home. Your mom's a teacher. Is she teaching at the same school as you?
No. Well, actually, some points. Yeah.
How did you take the school? Were you a good student?
Oh man, I never really loved school. I could do it.
Right.
You know what I mean? I was smart enough to like get what they were teaching and everything, right. but I never liked school.
Really?
When I was in high school, I think that there were semesters where I missed more school than I went to.
No shit.
I would go wait for the bus. And then wait for my mom to leave the house to go to work.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I saw her car pass, I would go back in the house.
Really?
Yeah.
What would you do in the house?
Or else I would walk down. I would watch rap videos.
Really?
Yeah. All day.
Like what, on the box?
On the box.
Yeah.
On BET, Yo MTV Raps, you know.
Yeah.
I'd have to wait for the shows to come on or whatever. And I would eat because I'm like a, I don't know, that's how I deal with my issues. I just eat.
Really?
I love to eat. I think. I've just always loved to eat.
Really? Were you ever like a fat kid or not?
Never fat.
I was going to say, you're like Skinny Bones Jones right now.
Well, yeah, I'm always skinny.
Yeah.
I've always been skinny. I've had a hyperactive thyroid.
Oh, okay.
And they found...
Really?
They found that out when I was 18. You know, I was all... You know, I...
Damn, lucky you, dog.
Yeah, in a way.
You're like, oh, I have to work out to try and stay big. I'm like, oh, I have to work out to try and not be obese.
Yeah, dude. I'm trying to gain muscle, like, all my life. You know, that's, like, my thing.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's like, I eat a lot of food, and I eat good food. And
you were an athlete as a kid, yeah? Soccer?
I still play soccer.
Yeah?
Yeah.
When did you start playing soccer?
When I was like 6.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Were you
my
good?
Mom was a soccer mom. I was great. I actually, in my mind, thought that I was going to go pro playing soccer.
No shit.
Yeah.
When did that become a different option?
Okay. So I played soccer as like, you know, as a child all the way into my teenage years. I was serious. I was on like the traveling select club.
You were probably
teams.
In a good spot for soccer too, because I feel like the Bay Area was an early adopter to soccer culture.
I think so too.
Yeah.
We were open minded up there.
Yeah.
You know, we had the facilities and stuff. And I, you know, my team did stuff like we traveled to Japan when I was
really?
11 years old.
Wow.
And we traveled to Europe when I was 14, 15, 16.
How would you guys do
times.
Over there?
We would get our asses kicked.
Because those are like cultures that revolve around soccer.
Yeah.
Probably.
Every game. Like when we went to Japan, we lost every game.
No shit.
Yeah. And like we maybe won one or two in Europe. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
But we did like multiple trips to Europe. And then I would. There's this Olympic development program.
Right.
Where you go through like you're a player on your city team, then you're a player on your district team, and then you're on your state team, then you make it to nationals. And I made it to like the city, the district, and then the state tryouts. And, you know, I wasn't as good as I thought I was.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But I was on the path to like, you know, get my mind thinking, oh, you're going to play in college. Maybe after college you can play.
There was no MLS back then.
I don't know. I think there was.
Was it? It was probably early on.
Yeah, but it was like a whack league.
Right,
like
right.
It would open up and close every couple of years.
Yeah.
It wasn't like the league they have now.
That's funny.
But then I was fucking around playing basketball when I was 18 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I went to touch the basketball rim. I jumped up, touched the basketball rim.
I saw
rim.
You about, you were like, I went up to dunk, but you stopped yourself.
No.
You went up to
no,
dunk?
No, that wasn't happening.
You had hops?
No.
No, okay.
I could touch the rim, like with the tip of my finger.
Yeah, go ahead.
Even though I was tall enough to where I should be able to dunk.
Right.
But I was not that coordinated.
Yeah. So you're out there Billy Hoyle-ing, and then what happened?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And then I land on a ball when I come down from the jump.
Oh, broke your ankle or something?
No, tore my ACL.
Oh, shit.
Meniscus, fucked up my knee. And then that sat me down.
Yeah.
And I was like, now what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And that's when I turned to the music.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
How long were you out for on that?
I had 3 knee surgeries total. And like each time I'd be out on crutches for... You know, like one time I think I was on, you know, fucked up for like 6 months.
Yeah.
And then the other two were like 2 months or something.
How was your headspace during that time?
I don't know. I got into the music, you know? I got into the music, so I wasn't tripping.
That's like a better coping strategy than probably how most people would
handle that. That's how I coped, yeah, for sure. Like, with everything that was going on. I moved out of my house pretty early, like 17, I think. You know, I didn't get along with moms, and I was like, because I didn't go to school. That was the main thing. She was like, you got to go to school. And then I was thinking rap, and she was like, turn that off. And
well, how would you, if you weren't going to school, how would you keep the grades up to play on the soccer team and stuff? Do just enough? Or
sometimes what? I couldn't play on the soccer team.
Oh, really?
And that was like heartbreaking.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know? So that's another reason why my soccer career wasn't going to go anywhere.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I wasn't making the grades. I wasn't going to go to college, you know, even though I thought I was, you know, after high school, I barely graduated high school.
Right.
And then I took like a couple, you know, junior college classes. And then I was like, I didn't even go to high school. How am I going to go to college?
Right. You know? Right. And so you move out at 17. Where did you go?
I went to a friend of mine's house, and his parents loved me, and my mother loved me too. I just was butting heads because I guess that's what teenagers do when they want to do their own shit and the parents want them to go to school. And so I did that, and then, you know, shortly after graduation, I think I just had some friends in Oakland who were like, let's all go get a spot.
Yeah.
And so I always lived in these houses or
like creative or enclave warehouse.
Yeah. Kind of like that.
Oh, I want to go back for a second. When you were saying that Hieroglyphics is the ones that like convinced you that oh, like, whoa, I'm seeing people that I know on TV and maybe that it could be real. It's so funny because Hieroglyphics is like, that was like my entry point into the like underground world. My friend gave me Third Eye Vision when I was like 17, maybe.
Yeah.
And I was like, and like Dell was everything to me and like A+ and all them fools. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh my God, like I've never heard rap like this.
Yeah.
And it was very shortly thereafter I moved to California, and like this is like very inside baseball, but I moved to Pomona to go to school at Cal Poly, and I was like talking to somebody had heard that I was smoking weed with that I liked rap music, and I was like, and they're like, dude, he was this Mexican fool, he's like, hey fool, you gotta fucking listen to Living Legends, dog. They're like so fucking underground that you're not even supposed to tell people about them. He's like, you gotta hear this fool, the Grouch. And that's like how
that's dope.
And that's like right when I moved to California, you're like the first name that got brought up. So let's talk about how you got to there. You start getting into these like little creative enclaves. Who are you living with?
Yeah, I gotta shout out Mexicans first. just cause you said
Mexicans are the best hip hop fans.
Mexicans love us.
Yeah.
And man, I just have so much appreciation for Mexicans. Being a Californian and growing up here, and and you said that, so I
yo,
just
shout
have to
out
make
Mexicans.
That,
that's how I found that, out about underground hip hop for real.
Sure.
Yeah,
yeah, but I forgot what you just
asked
me.
So when you move out at 17 and you start living in these kind of creative enclave warehouses and stuff, who are the people that you're living with?
To tell you the truth, the first group of people that I lived with were these people who just showed me love from high school. But they were like a church group, and they were like, we have this house over here. Do you want to live in it? And I was kind of like, they knew that they were probably looking at me like some sort of project.
Like you this, could be saved.
Yeah. Like this guy's kind of fucked up a little bit, but they liked me and they were cool guys. They were nice people. And that whole connection came because there was this girl that I thought was hot. Who went to the church. No.
Oh, okay.
She went to the church. Yeah. So I met these people up there, and I was like, I was really trying to, you know, be with this girl.
Yeah.
And then I ended up in this house. But then at some point, it turned into like they felt like they couldn't fix me. And I was like,
well, what kind of shit were you getting into? Because
I wasn't doing anything bad.
Were you ever like, did you ever have like a drug phase and stuff like that?
No. Well, I mean, I can get to that a little bit later
with the
Living Legends story.
Yeah. But, okay, cool.
But
at the time, nothing crazy.
No, I wasn't doing anything crazy. Maybe smoke a little weed here or there. But that was big to them, maybe, you know?
Yeah, right.
And then I was playing loud music in the house. And, you know, maybe I was inviting over friends that they didn't feel as comfortable with or something. Plus, being late on rent, shit like that. You know what I mean? And I think it got to this point where they're like, oh, this guy's taking advantage of us or something. And I really wasn't.
And
I just,
he's trying to get at the pastor's daughter. Yeah, get him out.
I just wasn't, Yeah, I just didn't have my responsibilities right. down at that point.
You're just
you know?
Like a fucking kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just being a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So eventually I moved out of there. Somebody threw like a mutual friend of someone there and someone I went to high school with, this girl, told me about Mystic Journeyman.
Right.
And they were doing independent hip hop. You know, I was going to school with Hieroglyphics and I was watching them on TV and I was hearing, you know, they're signed to Jive.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
This guy signed to Jive. This guy signed to Jive. First Dell is going to come out. Like, I was there before they did that and I was hearing their demo tapes. Like, we were passing tapes around in school. You know what I mean? And so we were hearing all the early versions, like the 4-track versions and the shit that they used to get signed. And so that was like this path that I recognized. I was like, oh, you make a demo and then you give it to a record company and you get signed. That was like, that's what everybody
was
doing.
That's how it was back
then. That's how it was. You know, there's A&Rs and you get your demo to an A&R and they listen to it. And then you go have these meetings in LA
yeah.
with these different record companies. And that's how everybody was doing it.
And it didn't really seem, there didn't seem like an independent option back then, did there?
Well, until I met Mystic Journeyman.
Yeah.
And that's, they were making music and their shit sounded like a demo tape
yeah.
when I first heard it. And I first got the tape from this girl, Katie. And then I listened to it and the way they presented it was like, this is not a demo tape. This is it. This is my album. This is my album.
Yeah.
And it was a fucked up 4-track recording and it was on a beat up little tape with maybe like a sticker on it that had some graffiti on it or
yeah.
something like that. And, you know, they had these little songs and they grouped them together, called it an album and was selling them, you know, on the street for $5.
Yeah.
Back when nobody was doing
that. That's like punk rock shit almost. Yeah. Yeah.
Like it was, you know, being independent before independent was cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Wait, can I ask you one quick, like, rap nerd question?
Yeah.
Being that you went to high school with all the Hyro guys.
Yeah.
Was Dell was going to high school there too?
Dell, I think Dell was either there on my last... I mean, he was on his last year when I was in my first year.
Was it like a known thing that he was like Ice Cube's cousin? Was that legendary at the time?
That was big.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was big.
Yeah, I could imagine. Because like that was like Ice Cube had like just gone solo. He was like the biggest rapper at the time. Probably.
That was one of the biggest points. And it was also a rumor or truth that, you know, Dell writes some of Ice Cube's raps.
Right.
Like
so people,
he wrote Gangster's Fairy Tale or something
so
like that.
So was he just like the man at school or what?
Definitely.
Yeah.
He was the man in the Bay Area.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in that genre
yeah.
of like hip hop, you know, because Too Short
right.
is the king.
Right, of course.
You know, but then it's like, oh shit, Too Short's like, I can't be like Too Short. I don't.
Right, that's not my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But these guys,
yeah.
you know, this is like, you know, because I'm listening to Too Short, then I'm listening to the East Coast, you know, KRS-One, Boogie Down Productions, and then later De La Soul and Tribe, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, and then when I see Hyro, I'm like, oh shit, we got a little bit of that vibe over here.
That was interesting. When I first found out about Dell, I was like, oh wow, this guy like kind of uses similar slang to how I would talk. Like he uses like big words and shit.
Right.
Like it was like cool smart rap all of a sudden that I hadn't heard before. So, okay. So anyhow, Mystic Journeyman are passing their tapes out and you get introduced to those are the first guys from the Legends that you meet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Those are the first guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were throwing these little parties already.
Yeah.
At, like, they had, you know, there was, like, some cafe or something that would let them come in on Wednesday nights and do a little night. And, you know, they were doing their shit. They were performing it. They were selling it. They were making posters. They were going to Kinko's and making flyers and just doing the whole...
Laying the blueprint for what everybody would do after them.
Yeah. So,
were you already the Grouch at this point?
Definitely not.
Okay.
Yeah. I wasn't even...
You hadn't made any music yet.
I had bought a sampler with one of my friends, and it was called Insonic Mirage.
Yep.
It was, like, before the EPS and before the ASR-10. And it had, like... Ours was, like, semi-broken, and it had, like, I think 2.5 seconds of sampling time.
Oh, wow.
And so we would spin the records like super fast and then like try to get as much of the sample as
and
you could.
Slow it down.
Slow it down and put it together, you know. And yeah. Like I think you could only do four different samples or something like that. It was crazy. Like ours was fucked up. Like and we would make little instrumentals with that. And then we would like put them on a tape and then we would take the tape and we would play it on a tape recorder or a boombox. And we would have another tape recorder recording, and we'd go sit in the car. That was our vocal booth.
Yeah,
you know
wow.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Because we figured the acoustics were, like, more isolated in a car.
That's so funny, man. And so the shit people had to go through.
Yeah,
like, so, kids these days, you don't know what you got, what we had to go through.
Yeah, so that's – and then like, we would, like – our mixing would be, like, how far – is the recorder from our mouth. Like, should we put it on the dashboard or should we put it on the seat next to us? And like, where are we going to put the source of the music? Should that be coming from the back seat? And so we'd like experiment to try to get the mix
for
together.
The dynamics. Yeah, and everything. Wow, dude.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Some dinosaur shit.
That's so crazy. How did they turn out?
They were funny. They were fun.
Yeah.
They were cool enough for me to play the Mystic Journeymen
yeah.
and have them say, oh, like, that's an idea.
What you know were you what rapping I mean? About?
You
don't have to spit
just
any bars.
Being
just
cool,
like, yeah,
just
yeah.
being cool and, like, not I'm not average. I think that was one of my first ones.
Yeah.
Don't judge me by how I look because
right.
I'm white,
right.
you know, because back then white guys
that
weren't rapping.
Of, yeah.
You know, I'm in Oakland. So
what was your school like? Was it super racially diverse? Was Oakland always kind of, as compared to San Francisco now, you know, they say like, oh, it's the city and then Oakland is where all the black folks are. Is that how it was when you were growing up?
I don't know how San Francisco was,
yeah.
but I know that Oakland in the flatlands,
yeah.
it was black schools
uh-huh.
and in the hills,
uh-huh.
it was more diverse.
Okay.
You know, and
where were you
at? To be honest, I went to two different schools. I went to a private school and then I got kicked out of there and that was in East Oakland. That was actually like there's a nice private school in the hood or semi hood, not so much hood. But you know, that was kind of multicultural, but more white over
yeah,
there.
Right.
And then I got kicked out of that one. But Tajay went to that school, and so did Latif from Quantum.
Right, right.
And so that's where I also was going to school with rappers. And then I got kicked out of that one, and then I went to one of the Hill schools in Oakland, which is the school that everybody, I think, wanted to go to
right.
at that time. And that's where... it's called Skyline High. And
shout out Skyline High.
Yeah, shout out Skyline High. And
so you grew up like in a pretty diverse culture then.
Yeah, it was yeah. very diverse up
right,
there. Yes.
Right.
I don't know what the percentages
yeah.
were, but we had Asians, we had black people, we had Mexicans, we
yeah.
had white people.
Yeah, I feel like, because now I feel like it's so democratized as to be able to make music now, and it's so kind of, and like rap culture is just so, has overtaken everything,
yeah.
you know what I mean? That I feel like there's probably white kids now that have never fucking met black people that try to rap and stuff, but you
yeah.
grew up around a lot of black folks, and you grew up around a lot of rap culture.
Oh, being, rapping, my first show was to all black people.
Yeah.
I was the only white person
right,
in there. My
right.
first year or two was
yeah.
that. You know what
like
I mean? It was like walking around the whole Bay Area.
Yeah.
There wasn't any other white people, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
right.
white people that I knew used to make fun of me for listening to rap.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And I guess that's kind of the point that I'm trying to make is like when I first heard you, I went, oh, whoa, this guy's white?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because like that was a... Even in the late 90s, early 2000s, like that was pretty rare. You saw Eminem on TV at the time,
yeah.
but there weren't, I didn't know that it was like a thing that
yeah.
could happen on an independent level even,
yeah.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, okay. So you meet the Journeyman and you play on the tapes that you're making on the four tracks,
right.
or not even on the four track, in your car. Basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and what do they say?
And they were like, okay, cool. And they were, at the time, they were doing little world tours where they would go to Australia and then
oh, really?
Go over to, you know, to Europe, you know, and go all through Europe.
How are
and
they doing that?
They would sell their tapes and they, as soon as they would make enough money, they would go straight to the travel agency in Berkeley. And like, there was this like, there was like a, travel agency that gave like students deals right by the college, and they had found it. And for some reason, they would give us the same deal as the students, even though we weren't students.
Wow.
And so they, we were like getting good. I remember back then, you know, like flying to, you know, London for like $350 round trip or something like that. I think, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it was one way each way. I don't know. But yeah, we would sell it. Well, I watched them do it first. Like when I first met them, they were like, oh, we just got back from a European tour. You know,
so that's,
I
was like, and you must have been like, oh, shit, that's crazy.
Yeah, I was like, oh, shit, I want to do that.
You guys are famous.
Yeah, I want to do that, you know. So I was on them, like, how do I do that? How do I be down? And they were like very, I can't think of the word right now, but, you know, they would always, resourceful.
Okay, yeah, right.
So at that point, my grandmother had passed away. And there was a vacant house that I had access to. So I was living there with, I had moved out of that other situation and I was living there with one of my other friends and I had space. And so I was like, yo, you guys need a spot, you know, because I wanted to be around the equipment and the life and learn and figure out how I could be down with what they were doing, you know? And they were like, yeah, that's great. You know, we just got back from a European tour. They would do shit like move out of their apartment, take all their money, and then go on the European tour. So
just
when
put
they,
everything in a yeah, storage it, or something?
Something like that.
Yeah, right.
So like when they came back, I kind of just caught them. They didn't have a spot. And so then we had like a spot together and they kind of showed me the ropes on how to use 4-tracks and samplers. And I think when I turned 18, I don't know how the years were at that time. Maybe I was 17 when I met them and then I turned 18.
Yeah.
And then I went, first thing I did when I was 18, I got a credit card.
Oh, shit.
And I maxed it out on an ASR 10.
Yeah.
Because a sampler back then was like, that thing cost me like $2,500. You know?
Really?
Yeah. So as a teenager, it's like, how are you going to get that kind of money if you're not doing something crazy?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And basically, I remember being in the Bay Area and knowing everybody in the Bay Area, like knowing the name at least of everyone in the Bay Area who had a sampler, who was into hip hop.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
A-Plus had one, you know, Casual had a SP-1200 or whatever. You know, and one of my rich friend's parents bought him an SP-1200. So I would go hang out. I would catch the bus all the way to Berkeley to go hang out there and just be around a sampler.
Yeah.
Like the shit was like, felt like magic.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like just to see an SP-1200, this is the machine that, you know, Large Professor is making beats on or something.
Right.
Oh, and it's in front of me and you got it. You know, let me touch it.
Right.
You know, that's how it used to be. So when I was 18, and I got the sampler, it was just like, you know, I was in heaven.
Yeah,
you know?
That's tight.
And I was in debt.
You know? I was going to say, like, as a responsible adult now, I hear like, oh, I got a credit card and maxed it out. I go, oh, God, my heart. But like, so did you have a lot of like credit trouble for a while?
I was just, I definitely was in debt for years.
Yeah.
But I was like, fuck it. I don't care
at
all.
Right.
I didn't even think about it.
Right.
You know,
that doesn't even matter at the time. So did you buy mics and stuff too? Did you guys have like a little home studio set up?
Yeah, we had a home studio set up. I had an ASR. You know, Sunspot from Mystic Journeyman, he worked on an Akai S1000, and he had a 4-track set up. And then eventually I got my own 4-track. You know, it was like sock over the microphone time, just dealing with like a Shure mic, you know. And yeah, there was one time where they went down to do some shows in Los Angeles, and they were like, they left me all the equipment, and they were like, when we come back, we want you to have an album together.
Did you do it?
I did it.
Which one was that?
It's called Don't Talk to Me.
Oh, yeah. I, of course, I know. Don't Talk to Me. So you did that in like a week?
Yeah, I did that in like a week.
No shit.
No, maybe a little longer. Maybe I had a couple of those ideas already going, but then I like actually recorded it.
Right.
And I put it, pretty fast.
You ever revisit those old records?
Man, I can't stand to listen to that stuff.
I mean, I'm the same way with my old stuff too. And I always wonder if everybody else is like that. Because isn't it crazy to you that there are still kids that like, that's what they're hearing you for the first time and like worship? worshiping it.
And sometimes they like that better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
I don't know how to explain it, but like being a rapper that's – I've been rapping now for like probably 15 years. You know what I mean? And like the only thing that I like is usually the last project that I put out. And I think I sound like an idiot on everything before. But when I hear people go like, oh, yeah, this one's all right, but the shit before it was better. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
How does that feel to you?
Oh man, I used to let it bother me, but now I don't care. If you like the early stuff, you like the early stuff.
Right.
You know, it's all there. It's all it's all recorded music for you to go back and listen to and decide what's your favorite. And you know, if you like me better back when I was struggling and rapping this way, then that's okay. That's what it's there for. Go back and listen to it.
And contextually, you know? Maybe those kids that are finding out about it now are going through what you were going through at the time.
So
you know
I understand it.
Right.
And when they get to be my age now, maybe they'll like what I'm putting out now more.
Right, right.
Maybe not.
You know, a 16-year-old kid's not going to relate to like, oh, hey, I have a daughter and a family.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean?
Yeah,
totally. That's interesting.
I like that. I like that different people like different things.
Right,
that
totally.
Makes me happy.
Totally. So what do you do after you have Don't Talk to Me?
After I have Don't Talk to Me, I hit the avenue with the guys.
Tapes?
Yeah, tapes.
Yeah.
Boombox.
Yeah.
Playing the boombox. People walking by saying, what the fuck? This is you?
Right.
You know what I mean? Because back then, it's like, now, if you try to sell a tape or a CD on the corner.
If you're on Hollywood Boulevard slanging
people
CDs.
People are like, get away from me.
Right. You're like a homeless person.
Yeah. You know? And so, but back then, no one, you know, I guess the closest thing I had heard to it was like Too Short sells albums out of the trunk of his car. You know what I mean? Or E-40 sells his tapes at the fucking liquor store on the corner. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, his tapes are like sitting up there next to the gum at the local liquor store. So,
yeah. So how, like on a good day, how many tapes would you have sold on a good day?
I feel like 20.
And would you make like 5 a pop or something?
Yeah, 5 a pop.
That's not a bad day's work. That's not a bad hustle.
Yeah, for a teenager, you know what I mean? And then we'd hit the Ave every day.
Yeah.
And so as soon as we would get that money for the ticket, then we were out. We'd be like,
where was the first place you traveled out of Oakland to go play a show?
Oh, man, I have no idea.
Really? You don't remember?
Yeah, I don't remember.
You think it was like Europe? I guess maybe the easier question is, do you think it was out of state or out of country?
I think I probably went out of country before out of state.
That's
because
so
that
crazy.
Was like the goal.
Yeah.
But shortly after that, we went out of state. Like,
how would you meet promoters to throw shows in Europe at the time?
Dude, we wouldn't. We would go, we would say, Farside has a show in Amsterdam. Let's show up at their show. And just holler at the people. Let's go during sound check time and say, yo, can we get on? And they would either say, yeah. Like we would be out there and we'd see people like Razzkaz or Farside. And they kind of knew Mystic Journeyman and heard some stories. And they'd be like, oh, shit. You know, they'd be on their label tour that has them staying at nice hotels and
buses and shit.
And buses and shit. And we'd be like rugrats, like, yo, can we get on?
Yeah.
And they'd be like, oh, shit, how are you guys out here in Amsterdam? Because
that's so crazy.
This is before, you know, there's not a lot of underground hip hop touring at all at this time. You know what I mean?
That's so funny. That made me like a little giddy to hear, to like have that context of you as the like struggle kid out there asking to get on. Cause I've been that kid to you for like forever. I've opened up probably a dozen shows for you over time of just like bugging promoters. Like, please let me open for the Grouch. I think his fans would like my stuff. Please. You know?
Yeah.
And it's like the same thing that you were doing with the Farside.
Yeah.
And so they would start to recognize you at shows and shit.
Yeah. Sometimes like that. Or sometimes they would say, nah, we don't want those guys. We're not associating with those guys. Or sometimes they would say, yeah, we don't give a fuck. Let them on for a couple songs. Or you
know, if they didn't, would you guys just stand in the parking lot and try to slam?
Exactly. Exactly. If they didn't, we would still, you know, just stand out there and sell. Like we used to – I feel like we used to strong arm or punk people into buying our shit.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Totally, totally.
And
oh, you haven't heard of this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's great.
You need to get this right now.
Yeah.
You got $5 in your pocket, pull it out.
Yeah, you're not a real hip hop fan. Yeah.
You know what I did to get all the way over here? Come on, show some love.
That's so tight.
So
when did it start catching on in California?
We were doing these things called Underground Survivors.
Uh-huh.
And they were these like showcases at this cultural center in Oakland called La Pena Cultural Center.
Okay.
And every Wednesday night, it was kind of like what we heard they were doing at the Good Life Cafe.
Okay, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like there'd be like a house band for anybody who like, because I remember there were some people that were like doing jazz stuff and just poetry readings.
Uh-huh.
And then there were some people doing hip hop, and there were some people doing organic hip hop with like a band. And then there was other people who had like their own beats,
uh-huh.
you know, going off dat tapes,
uh-huh,
you know? And so every week that would happen and be just kind of like a, you know, underground bohemian style gathering, and people would hear about it and they would come through, and, you know, it got to be a cool function that everybody counted on and went
like
to
every week.
Yeah. Every yeah. week, every yeah. single week.
What so, day was it on Thursdays too?
It was on Wednesdays.
On Wednesdays.
Yeah.
My first time ever seeing you perform, I remember you had some song where you say, like, I didn't get to go out on them Thursdays, which was like a reference to the Good Life and the Project Blowed Shit or something, I think. I don't remember what song that is. But coincidentally, the first time that I saw you was in Leimert Park at the Chaos Network.
Yeah.
And like I said, I was going to school in Pomona at the time when I was like 19.
Mm-hmm.
And me and some friends, it was right after I'd heard about you, we heard coincidentally that the Living Legends were going to be at this little venue, and we drove up thinking like, oh, we hope the show doesn't sell out. So we stood in Leimert Park from 1 o'clock in the afternoon until the show started at like 9, just smoking weed in line and stuff like that.
Crazy.
And we were the first people there, and eventually, which is so corny now to think back, but eventually there was a line around the block, and it was like, you know how small that little room is, and it was just packed. One of my friends like passed out from heat stroke. So yeah, that's my first time ever seeing you perform. Okay.
Nice.
Now that being said, when do you start meeting the collaborative or the collaborative entity that became Living Legends as a whole?
Yeah, that was, you know, simultaneously what was going on down south. We were in the Bay Area up north, and down south, Merce, Scarab, and Eli, which were...
They were going to Hamilton down here, right?
Yeah, something like that. And they were like... Yeah, they were high school or fresh out of high school, but they had already been a group together, Three Melancholy Gypsies.
Right.
And they were doing recordings. And...
Had you guys seen their music video?
Not at all.
Okay.
I didn't know anything about them at all.
That one where they sample Nirvana, I can't remember the song's called now, but they have a high school video.
Yeah, I know that song.
Right.
I don't know why I'm blanking on the title
it's
of that
Sun
song.
It's Sun something.
Sunspray.
Sunspray, there you go. Yeah, yeah.
So that's an amazing song for those young guys to come up with.
It is.
Yeah. But I met Eli because a friend of mine was dating his cousin in Oakland.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
And he met me. He was either 15 or 16, and I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 18, a guy who was 2 or 3 years younger to me, I was like, that's a kid. I don't even want to hang around
right,
with
totally.
That dude. You
yeah.
know? And his cousin kept saying, you should meet my cousin. You should meet my cousin. He does music. And I already probably had like some sort of a little ego at that point. I was hanging around Mystic Journeyman. I was like, man, this dude's a little dude, white rapper. You know what I mean? I don't know if I want to.
He had like dreads at the time.
Yeah, he had dreads. Yeah. He had all these rings. He was like, you know, super baggy clothes. He's kind of like bohemian dude or, you know. And I thought that was weird because I was always like more of a clean cut regular guy.
Right.
And I didn't have any friends like that. But met him. All he really wanted to do was get close to my sampler. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
learn how to make beats on the ASR 10. And the more I hung out with him, I was like, all right, dude is cool. He can rap.
Right.
You know, his style is unique.
He came up to visit you then?
Yeah. He came up to stay at his cousin's house in the Bay Area.
Oh, okay.
And so I met him
how
over there.
How fucking crazily serendipitous is that? Like, this is all like pre the internet getting popularized.
Yeah.
And you guys were just through word of mouth.
Well, it gets deeper than that.
Yeah.
Because so at that point, I have this relationship with Eli. And then I have him meet my friends, Mystic Journeyman, and exactly at the same time, we're like, you know, this is probably like a week later. I still don't know anything too much about Eli's group and history and where he's from and all that stuff. Me and Mystic Journeyman go do a radio show in Santa Cruz at the college. And up there is Merce. And so we meet Merce because he knows some people in Santa Cruz who like work at the radio station. And just like I said, being around microphones and equipment and radio and like all that shit is just, you want to be around it as much as you can at that point. And so he's hanging out at the radio station. We go meet him. So I meet Merce without even knowing that he has any connection to Eli, but I already know Eli. And so somehow or another, we figure out, oh, shit, you know Eli? He's in my group. You know? And so it's all like, whoa, this is crazy.
How's he as a teen?
Who, Merce?
Yeah.
Oh, man, Merce. He's just like a feisty little, you know, I'm doing everything my way. I'm not doing anything you say, anything that you want me to do. I'm doing the completely opposite.
Yeah.
You know, you guys all want to go here and perform here. Fuck that. I'm not going there. I'm going to the movies, you know?
Yeah.
Like
stubborn in a sense.
Stubborn. Yeah. Me and him butt heads. Like, he's the only person who's ever punched me in my face in my life.
Get out.
Yeah, Merce.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you guys all establish like long-standing friendships eventually?
Most definitely.
Yeah, yeah,
most
yeah.
definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love Merce.
Why did he punch you in the face?
But we hated each other for a while.
Really?
But not really, but it was kind of like a, you know, a competition and, you know, egos and I don't know.
He seems like somebody, from my experience with Merce, it's like he's a person where he will not trust you at first, but when he finally does, then you're cool.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Like, it's hard to get on his good side initially.
Most definitely.
Right. Yeah. Why did he punch you?
I don't remember.
You don't remember?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
It's so small, you know, but we all lived in a house. Yeah. I mean, not a house, a warehouse. At that, like,
yeah, you guys have the Mystic Journeyman warehouse that's in a lot of videos and stuff, right?
After we met everybody, we were all like, yeah, let's do this. Let's be a crew. And there were some kids, there were some guys who had a warehouse. They had just signed a lease for this East Oakland warehouse, which was like 2,500 square feet. And none of us like had our shit together enough to like get a lease like for such a cool place. You know what I mean? I don't know, to like get a landlord to trust us with like a real spot like that. And it was like a real, you know, they started to do these renovations of these old buildings and turn them into live work spots in East Oakland. And so
who is it at the time? It's you, Mystic Journeyman, which is PSC at the time, and
Eli,
and Sunspot, Merce, Scarab.
Scarab was going to school. Scarab was the only one out of the melancholy gypsies who decided he was going to go to college after high school.
Okay.
And so...
So who else was in there then?
Well, the people who signed the lease was a guy named Picasso.
Yeah, Picasso. Okay.
Picasso and his friend Gabe. They had come from... They had, like, gone to school in Humboldt.
Okay.
And decided they didn't want to go to school anymore. And they wanted to come work on music in the Bay Area and be creative.
Right.
So they got this warehouse. And somehow or another, we met them and we knew they got this big warehouse. So we were all kind of converged on their shit over there.
Right.
And we're like, can we stay? Can we live here? This warehouse is dope. It's big. And we could all be creative in this place. And so we started living together. And it was all those guys you said. And then there was Aesop. He had come from Fresno. Aesop was a guy who was, he was constantly getting in where he fit in.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right,
and
right.
He's kind of like taking advantage of anything that he could take advantage
right,
of. He's
right.
like a go-getter, kind of like, you know, he's a funny character.
He's
a good dude. But, He definitely was like, I'm in on this. Like, you know, he was coming to those Wednesday night shows and he was like, I'm down. I want to be in this. Like, whatever.
He saw what was bubbling up.
Yeah, he saw what was
like,
bubbling
oh,
up.
This is going to be something.
Yeah. I'm a part of this.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So he lived in there too. Basically, we had 9 or 10 or 11 guys in this 2,500 square foot warehouse, one bathroom. We all built like these little corner rooms. You know, some people like me, I actually got the 2x4s out and the the drywall and built myself a little room.
Yeah.
Merce lived on top of me.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And so, and we just had, he
in
just
bunk
had.
Bunk beds. No, I'm just kidding.
No, not in bunk beds, but it was, you know, bungalows.
Upstairs. Like he had like a little loft.
Yeah, like a bungalow.
Yeah.
And like, but his floor was like made out of plywood. Yeah. And every time he would like drop something on the floor, it would be like amplified, like, you know, banging my room and shit.
Yeah.
So we had this whole like living on top of each other vibe going on where I was like
more tension.
Yeah, like, you know, when he had girls over,
I'm hearing it.
You know what I mean? And it's just like,
yeah, how was that with 11 dudes? Was it like was it a madhouse?
It was a madhouse, dude.
Parties and stuff?
Parties, girls, you know, drugs, but not like weed drugs, weed and mushrooms.
Yeah, I was gonna say, was there anything reckless? Like
nothing reckless.
Yeah, that's good.
But we like had a dope spot, and like, you know, we'd take mushrooms and then climb on the roof, and like we'd be all in East Oakland on the roof, but we were kind of like in this fortress of this big live work. It was like an old, I don't even know, like a shipping and packing center that they turned into.
So you guys got to just be the center of your own little universes right there.
But it was the hood, you know, semi-hood, you know. Very creative space, though. We had, like...
What projects are getting pumped out of there?
Nothing Changes I made there. Success is Destiny I made there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, Success is Destiny I made in a studio in Oakland, but I was living at that warehouse at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I made the first two on the 4-track, and then I was like, oh, I want to go to somebody else's studio and try to make it sound cleaner and record on ADAT or whatever, you know. And so...
Yeah, I've read stories about that, like the Living Legends warehouse, and kind of like heard, you know, little bits and pieces over the times that I've met you guys over the years. And it sounds like, looking back, I would imagine there has to be a certain sense of like nostalgia, and like that was like probably a super just happy time of life. Yeah?
Oh man, it was fantastic.
The best, right?
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
We would make music, you know, like the highlight of the week would be going to the Wednesday night Underground Survivors event. And so we would make music for that. And we would like
every week.
Yeah. Like, you know, it'd be a Tuesday, and Sunspot had his bungalow was like in the middle of the whole warehouse. And he would like invite people up because he had his studio there, and you would just go up one by one and drop your verse.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right,
and it'd be like, Sometimes we'd even do it on the day of the show, and he would be like, we got 45 minutes. Everybody got to drop their verse before we get out of here.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And then we just go get the microphone with the sock and just cycle through and make songs. And like, we were knocking out songs every day.
Right.
And that was like, you know, there was also he put out a lot of projects like Underground Survivors, UHB, Unsigned and Hella Broke. He always had these like more like compilation type things with us before we were even calling ourselves the Living Legends.
Right. And that's probably a pretty smart move, because it starts to show the scene that's going on and what everybody is bringing to the collective.
Yeah.
Does that start a certain mythology around you guys locally?
Yeah, definitely. See, they were Mystic Journeymen first, and that was the story. Like, they were Mystic Journeymen, but then all of a sudden, we all get involved, and it started to get big really fast. Like, people like that, oh, who are all these guys?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, to an extent, it was like, I used to hear like, oh, they're like the West Coast Wu-Tang.
Yeah. You
know what I mean?
Yeah, we wish we were that.
Right.
I mean, at that point.
Right.
We're like, oh, Wu-Tang, and like, you know.
There's always that context, like whenever there's a big group, you're like, oh, they're the new Wu-Tang.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I definitely heard that when I got introduced to you guys.
Yeah, and then there was, I want to say that we were also inspired by Far Side, because they had this thing called the Far Side Manor. I don't know if they really lived there, but they, like, on interviews, they'd have, like, some big house that they all chilled in and kicked it in. And so, like, we felt like we had our own version of that.
That's tight.
You know, because they were some other people that we were definitely inspired by as, like, hip-hop, West Coast, non-gangster.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And did you guys start touring around locally at this point or no?
Yeah, probably around that point. I, you know, as soon as we start calling ourselves, you know, I get mixed up with these time periods, but in 97, I think, is when we started calling ourselves Living Legends.
That's interesting. That's crazy, because I always, like, when I heard about you guys, like I said, it was like around 2000.
Yeah.
And I just figured that you guys had been around forever at that point. Like, because it's to me, as like this young kid listening and hearing independent hip hop for like kind of the first time, it was like sounded so polished. And I'm like, Living Legends, these guys have been rapping since like the 80s, dog. Or so, you know what I mean? I was like, I was like, they're legendary. Like,
Mystic Journeyman was probably 93, 94.
Yeah.
And then I came out with Don't Talk to Me, 95.
How'd you come up with the name? I never asked that question. It's so generic, but
That's all right.
Yeah.
The Grouch, because, you know, I remember saying my whole thing when I first started performing, like I said, I was a white guy coming into a black culture, and I was, you know, making sure I didn't do anything wrong. So I'm like, you know what? I'm not coming with ego. I'm not coming with bravado. My shit is like, I'm just me. I'm just a simple dude. I'm a regular guy. I love everybody. I'm about peace. And so I would lay that out in a speech before I perform and just said, I'm a regular dude. My name is Corey Scoffern, you know? And so I was just had a regular name. I just used my name at that point. And, you know, people were down with that. And, but
hey, that was a very early adopter. You could have been the first. Like, that's like very trendy now to be a real name rapper.
Yeah, yeah.
You could have been the first.
Yeah, yeah. But at some point, we're living together in that warehouse. Probably. Yeah, I don't. Man, see, that's why I don't know how the dates work.
Yeah,
maybe it wasn't even in that warehouse.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
At some point when I'm living with Sunspot Jones, we get into an argument because, you know, we're in close quarters all the time and
roommates fight.
And he's like, fuck you. You're the Grouch. You know what I mean? You're just the Grouch, like in the middle of an argument.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, whoa, okay, I'll take that.
Yeah.
You know, I analyzed like calling yourself the something makes people say, oh, who is that?
It sounds a little more esteemed or something, you know?
You know, so.
Which is funny because over the years that I've encountered and met you in various degrees of knowledge of each other, you've always been so nice. So I was like, oh, his name doesn't fit.
Right.
You know what I mean? I was like, why do they call him? I was like, the first time I met you as a 19-year-old kid, I was like, oh my God, he's going to be like so mean and scary.
Yeah, yeah,
and then I was like, oh, hey, he fucking smiles and he's like nice and asks questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the time, I guess I was complaining about, you know, I'm a teenager.
Yeah.
I don't have much money.
Yeah,
I'm not living with my mom. I'm kind of struggling. Like, I feel broke.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I didn't have much money. I didn't come up with money. I didn't, you know, I wasn't going to college. So, like, all my shit was complaining. I would get a lot of speeding tickets and traffic violations. And I felt like, you know, cops wouldn't give me a break.
Are you
and
a
stuff.
Bit of an introvert too?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't have any friends really.
Yeah.
You know, before
that's the
I met
thing.
These guys.
I think, like, even if you are a nice person, if you're introverted and you're living around a ton of people and you're not getting the alone time you need, you can seem like a fucking grouch.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that can happen.
And then I'm feeling like I'm the white guy in this culture.
Right.
And, like, I don't know if anybody likes me.
Right.
You know, and then I'm making my album, like, Don't Talk to Me, as kind of like, really what I want is everybody to talk to me.
Right.
But at the time, I don't know that.
Yeah.
I'm just like, fuck, man. The world is against me. You know, my cars are fucked up. I don't have enough money to pay for them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'm not eating good. And, you know, I'm sleeping on fucked up couch bed things. And, you know.
Right.
But really, that was just part of the process. And,
totally.
You know, I'm glad I went through that, you know?
When do you guys move out of that place? Like, how far along are you?
I don't know, man.
Yeah. Did it just kind of wither away or was
it was kind of just like, we're all, like, our shit started to grow and we start have egos and we started to make a little bit more money. So, like, now I don't have to record on Sunspot shit. I got my own shit. Yeah. I'm going to move down the street to my own. I can afford to, like, get my own place. And that was really, like, fulfilling to me. Like, when I started to make my own money and, like I always tell people that the time that I realized I was doing good and that I could, what convinced me that I could make it is when I bought a vacuum cleaner.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, because I was like,
because it's mundane. And
because
it's like,
yeah. If I have enough money to spend it on a fucking vacuum cleaner,
I'm comfortable.
Then I'm doing something right.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
And so that's the point when it like hit me that like I can do this.
Right.
You know.
And so I want to try to take you back to a time where like probably I was like most into you guys and see if you can tell me stories about this. So when I permanently moved to California, it was 2001. And at this point, I was going back home for the summers to Alaska, and I was making like mix CDs with like all your shit on it, whether it was like G&E or like CMA with mm-hmm. you and PSC, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, stuff from Fuck the Dumb, stuff from Don't Talk to Me, yada, yada, yada. And then mixing it in with other contingencies from other areas like Rhymesayers stuff or like Def Jux stuff. I was putting all that stuff on mix CDs for people at home.
Yeah.
And so when I moved home or moved back to California, I was living in Santa Barbara going to a photo school. And I moved in with this girl that used to shoot bands. And one day I go home and she's like talking to, I'm not going to say who it was, but she was talking to one of the Living Legends, and I went, holy shit, you're on the phone with a Living Legend. And she's like, yeah, we can like go to Riverside and shoot their show. And I said, and like, we can like go backstage and stuff. I went, oh my fucking God. You know, so we go down there and do this, like I said, so long ago, but I think you had already met your wife, like who is your wife now, mm-hmm. at the time. And you guys are on the road and we end up, going down there, shooting the show, and this one still shooting film, and it was all these things. Like, we were looking at you guys like you were rock stars, and we had this photo shoot planned out for the morning after the show and all this shit.
Mm-hmm.
But things didn't go as planned with somebody in the group, and and somebody was banging on the door in the middle of the night of our hotel room, and like all this shit went wrong. But the one thing that I really remember about that is that we went to like a I don't know, fucking TGI Fridays or something. And somehow I end up sitting next to you at a table, and and this is the craziest thing. It was the night, it was really nice too. So it was like, this paints you in a good light. But I'm sitting there in like a bright orange hieroglyphic shirt, and you're like, oh yeah, hieroglyphics. I'm like, yeah, you know, they're like my favorite. And you're like, oh, where are you from? And I was like, Alaska. And you're like, whoa. And all of a sudden, like a real conversation started where you were asking questions about like, oh, what's that like? And this and that. And I was like, dude, this guy is the fucking best. So cool. And so right around that time, like a couple years later is when like the big Living Legends album comes out, the first one. Because you'd already done like Angels with Dirty Faces and stuff. What was the first one called? I think it was the one before you guys were in baseball uniforms.
Almost Famous.
Almost Famous comes out. Yeah. And that was like, to me, that was like the peak when I was into you guys the most.
Yeah.
What's that time of life like? Because you guys were heavy buzzing, like, and things were probably going great at the time.
Man, okay. Let me try to get to that. I will say the first nationwide tour we went on, Hiro took us on.
Yeah.
So we went around the country, and we got – that was like laying the foundation for us to just create this Living Legend in – the United States.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we were doing the tours to Europe, and we were also hitting Japan all the time, and we were doing good in Japan. They loved us in Japan. Living Legends started to get big. People wanted a Living Legends album, but like you said, there was only Angels with Dirty Faces, and then there were these unsigned and hella broke compilation things. And then we were like, we had met, Rhymesayers guys like on a trip around the country, and just the word was just starting to blow. Like, we
how
were
was it touring with that many people? Was it good? Was it good?
It was fantastic.
It was awesome.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah, you guys had a lot of fun.
Yeah, so much fun.
That's good.
But it was also like quick, and like you know, I took a lot of the travel for granted back then.
Right.
And like didn't absorb everything. And we started to blow. And that's a little bit early right there. So we still kind of had our heads on, and we were still just riding off this creative energy. Like, we all just were creating so much stuff. And that was like the coolest part about it. And watching people react to that and going to like, showing up in the different cities for the first times, and they know the raps, you know what I mean? And like seeing that and feeling like, oh, we're doing it, you know, and getting the magazine articles when we go to Japan and stuff like that. But there was a part of me that was like, we still have to lock it down and make a real album. That was my thought before Almost Famous.
Yeah.
And we were going to Japan and we were technology heads. Like we wanted the coolest samplers. We wanted the little beat machines that you could make portable beats on the airplane. We wanted to be able to record on the road. And that was like, you know, this is all unheard of back then. So we did all the studying up. Roland is coming, like back then everybody's recording on ADATs, you know. And so Roland is coming out with a portable recorder.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot what it's called. I'm stupid because I should know that.
It's
because
all
right. it was so ingrained in us that, like, we knew the dates that shit was dropping.
Right,
We knew when the first CD burner, CD burner was coming out. And, like, back then, shit didn't come out. Like, Apple wasn't on top of the game, and they didn't have the most advanced technology. Sometimes you had to go to Japan to get it.
Right.
So, like, we would go to Japan and get shit that wouldn't be out in America yet.
Wow.
And, you know, that was our goal, was to be portable. So, like, when we travel around the country, then I can just be in, like, we would travel in Winnebagos, RVs at the time.
Yeah.
And I would have this Roland 1680 machine hooked up in the back of the RV and invite Slug over to our RV and have a beat going.
Drop a verse.
And that was like amazing at the time that you could be on the road and record something like that. And
I think people are still surprised by that. Like, that's still amazing.
Yeah,
it's tight.
And so that's how we were putting together that album. I was like, I actually, you know, I don't like to, like, be on my own dick, but I mean, not even, I'm not even saying that, but I did spearhead a lot of that album, and I had it in that Roland machine. You know? I laid the beats down. I made a lot of the beats. Eli made a lot of the beats, and we had, like, the skeleton for the album inside this machine.
Yeah.
And to be honest, there was a point where I was like, man, Sunspot keeps making these little compilations and shit, and it's not called Living Legends. It's called, like, Sunspot Jones, Angels with Dirty Faces, but it has all of us on it.
Right.
Fuck that.
Yeah, that felt like a Living Legends album.
Yeah, exactly. And he would sell that, and he'd make all the money for that one at that point, because we were, like, in the wild, wild west of understanding how business is going to work and all that. And so I was like, fuck that. We need an actual Living Legends album that we all make equal money off of, and that is like a cohesive album. And so we put that together in the Roland 1680. And then I think we took it and then, like, had the portable box that we got all the pieces on. And then we brought it to a studio and exported it out.
Yeah. Cause here, it sounded polished
here in LA.
Yeah. It was, I feel like, if my memory serves me correctly, it sounded like much more polished than any
the other
of the
stuff.
Individual projects had sounded before.
Cause Eli and I were always, like, so intrigued with trying to get the best quality.
Yeah.
And also, we were underground, but we were like, we want to sound like the big dudes.
Right.
We want to be like, there's a lot of, there's always, like, you know, throughout our career, a longing to be like the other guys who are like, oh man, you know.
Well, and that goes back to, like, what I opened up with, of like, yo man, you fucking built a life off this. But yeah, when you're doing it, you're never satisfied.
Yeah, never satisfied.
Like, you probably don't feel like you reached the goals that you wanted to reach, but you've reached goals that so many people wish they had.
I understand.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, so that's what I meant
by
that.
I go back and forth.
Absolutely.
With, like, you know, feeling grateful for what I have and then saying, why didn't I get to make it onto MTV?
And you know, the older I get, though, the more that I think that's just a creative mind state.
Yeah.
Like, that's just how people think when you're doing this. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
But nah, man, you did it.
But yeah, I mean, but so we were like, you know, I want to record at the same studio the Dog Pound records at.
Right.
You know what I mean? So we looked that up in LA and we found, like, someone who engineers for them. And, you know, we, like, went and got it mixed there and stuff like
how
that.
How did it feel when you guys put it out? Was it anticlimactic?
No, it was good. It was good.
Yeah.
It was good.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't remember exactly what happened. I remember, like, securing, like, independent distribution deals.
Yeah.
And feeling like we had, you know, getting our shit in Best Buy.
Right.
Like local Best Buys, like not nationwide, but like local Best Buys. And then, you know, we always wanted our shit to be in all the real stores as well as the Amoebas and the Leopolds and Rasputins. And, you know, because we did, during the early days, we did all our own distribution and we dealt with these mom and pops all across the country.
Did you guys have like a phone network?
Phone network.
Or would you, okay. Yeah. Would you also go like in during the tours, go to
knock on
their doors, basically.
Definitely. Yeah. And so we had that locked down. I mean, we made great money like that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because you would have like a local mom and pop that hits you up like, oh, hey, we sold out of your CDs. Yeah. We're going to send you fucking $50. Send us more.
I remember Planet Asia working in, he used to work in Amoeba in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And our shit was cracking off. And he had moved from Fresno to the Bay Area. And he was starting to get with people. And he was a dope rapper. But he wasn't, you know, he wasn't fully established yet. And and I was going into Amoeba and killing it. Like, I remember showing him like $5,000 check that I got from Amoeba.
Mm-hmm.
Just from bringing in a couple boxes of CDs.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And thinking, and him seeing that and me just not being in belief, like I'm a teenager.
That's
early.
That's crazy.
And I was getting a $5,000 check from the Berkeley Amoeba. Then I was getting in my car and driving over to San Francisco and hitting them like that.
Wow.
And then I'm going, you know, and then when they opened the one up in LA, it's like, yeah, we used to make good money like that.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
great. That's
I didn't have to tour. All I had to do was sell CDs, and I was living good.
Wow.
You know? And people would always say, well, you got to tour to make your money. And like as later, you know, as things progressed, it got to be more like that. But for a while, underground CDs, we were just killing it.
That's crazy. I've never heard numbers like that on the physicals. That's amazing.
I mean, you know, I was buying cars in cash and shit like that.
Wow.
I was like,
so you were living the rap life.
I mean, not okay. I'm talking.
It was a sensible Volkswagen. All
no,
right?
It was not like something crazy.
Yeah,
but I remember paying. Like, I remember saying, I don't want to be in debt. I want to buy a car in cash and be done with it. And
that's
and I did that once in my life.
Yeah.
Once in my life.
Right.
You know what I mean? I bought a house as a young, you know, 23 or 4 year old, you know, you know, but that's when I was richest.
Right.
Money wise.
Right. Right.
You know?
So when you guys put out Almost Famous, like, what's the response like? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
It just did well. I remember it did well in Japan.
Yeah.
It did well in Europe.
Yeah.
It did, you know, it did well everywhere. And that kind of just put us on this, on the next level to where, like, we had a booking agent.
Right.
You know, what's it called? Peter Schwartz.
Yeah, the agency.
The
now.
Agency group.
It used to be called something else, but it's like, the agency group now.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So right around that time, just at, contextually as a rap fan, it was so interesting because I was like a little early on all you guys that were kind of like the alt indie rap scene, and it was like that same year, like right around 2001, where I felt like all of you guys took it to the next level at the same time. It was like the Living Legends, boom, this big official album, and then like I think Slug had put out God Loves Ugly, and that got a lot of national attention.
Yeah.
And like I think LP shortly thereafter put out his first big record, and it was just like, and I was like, whoa, all these guys are like, it's fucking on right now for you guys. And I remember you guys went on a big national tour for that. Yeah.
Yeah. We actually, right before Almost Famous, I think we had moved, we had made this move from Northern California, is where we were in the warehouses and stuff. And then I met my wife up there because I started getting popular and I was able to get girls for the first time that I thought were amazing. And I met her up there, and we all decided, let's move down to L.A. and really, you know, because that's what we thought. We, you know, in the Bay Area, we had taken it pretty far. Like, we were selling out 2,500-person venues, this place called the Maritime Hall in San Francisco. So we were, like, having cracking shows. Like, it was, like, Living Legends was the shit. In the Bay Area, you know, and we could do it over and over and over again.
Really?
Yeah. So
was it like that in L.A. too?
Not as big. And that's what we were like, we need to take what we have in the Bay and make this in L.A.
So did everybody come down to L.A.?
Yeah, pretty much everybody. Merce and...
He was like home for him.
Yeah, Merce, Eli, Scarab had already been from there. Lucky I Am was from Los Angeles as well, but he had been in the Bay doing Mystic Journeyman.
Where were you staying in L.A.? What part of the city were you in?
Actually, I wasn't even really in L.A. I was in the Valley.
Oh, really?
That's where I could afford a house.
Yeah. Oh, so you bought?
So I bought a house.
Look at you. That's crazy. I Here I am, 34. I still don't have any, chance at fucking buying a house in the L.A. area.
That's hard, man.
That's tight. What part of the Valley were you in?
They call it Lake Balboa, but it's really dressed up part of Van Nuys.
Okay. How did you like living down here as opposed to the Bay where you'd grown up?
Pretty much I just stayed in the studio. I converted my garage into a studio, and I feel like I stayed in there the whole time I was here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you still building new relations with people? What I've always been interested throughout your career is that you collab with a lot of folks, and it seems like you make long-lasting friendships with a lot of folks you collab with. Who were you meeting around that time?
Well, I got close with Slug a little bit because Merce and Slug were doing Felt.
Oh, right, right.
And I produced that first one. Yeah. And Slug came out here, and we all did that in my garage.
Nice.
In down here. And then Abstract Rude is really a close one to me. I just always loved his stuff. And then being down here, I mean, to be honest, I didn't get out and do what I was supposed to do in L.A. Like, I didn't go schmooze and hang out and any of that stuff. You know, I recorded a couple songs. I hung out more with AC Alone and Abstract Rude than I would have if I lived in the Bay, but still not so much.
Right. But at that point, you're like essentially already a family man. You got your girl.
Yep.
And you got a house.
I got a house.
And there's like,
and I live in the Valley.
It's like, what's the point of going out?
And there's
really
traffic everywhere.
Yeah, totally.
And it's like, that's what I learned that made me want to get out of here.
Yeah. How long did you stay here?
I stayed for 8 years, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And here, this is me making a confession. I didn't keep up with the later part of it.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. So I don't know what happened in those 8 years. What have you guys been through? I know G&E got really popular.
Okay, this is what happened. Yeah. Living Legends blew up off of that Almost Famous, and then we did Creative Differences, I think, and then we did Classic. We did Well, that's a lot of time. But, okay, Almost Famous, then Creative Differences, then we had the blow up, and you were talking about big tours nationwide. Yeah. We did that a few times, and we got pretty big. We were hot, you know what I mean? Every city that we came to, there were girls. We were listening to, you know, we were underground rappers, but we're listening to 50 Cent, Dog Pound, J.O. Felony, you know, even Hot Boys back at the time. And we were getting pumped off that shit, before we would go do our shows.
Right.
And so we got big buses, and they're filled up with girls, and they're filled up with drink.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we're drinking. I'm drinking to almost a point of passing out every single night.
What was your drink?
We're drinking mostly Hennessy.
Yeah.
Shout out
to Hennessy.
Yeah, shout out to Hennessy.
One of our sponsors.
But not really. Yeah.
So how long is that going on before? I imagine that you're saying that there was some kind of crescendo where you realized, oh, this is a problem now.
I was with my girl, and I was doing all that.
Yeah.
You know, and I was, what else happened? Yeah, I was feeling shitty. Like, I would come home from literally a 60-day run of hitting the Hennessy bottle every single day to almost a blackout point, and then waking up and just trying to lay in the bunk of the bed and drink water all day so I could do it again.
Right.
You know? And then certain guys were going harder than that
and
starting to pick up other things.
So does it start to feel empty or something?
Well, I get in trouble with my wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, but that I almost lost her, and that was, you know, she's my love of my life. And so she was, or one of them, you know, but I didn't want to lose her. And so, you know, there was a huge breakdown with that at some point. And, I remember coming back from, I left a tour early, we were all in Germany and, you know, some shit hit the fan, and then I came home, and then
to try and like to fix settle it. A beef. Yeah.
And then, you know, somehow or another, I was able to pull it off.
Yeah.
Keep her. And then I was like, you know what? This shit wasn't serving me anyway, you know, because I'm going down something that's not, I'm going down a road that's not sustainable.
Uh-huh.
I can't get drunk like that. I can't, you know, we were inviting girls on stage and doing, like the music started to go into a more party direction,
right.
You know, and those parties were great and they were fun and they were learning experiences, but it wasn't something that was sustainable.
Yeah.
And
well, it seems like to an extent when you're playing that many shows, you start to realize probably that like the turn up songs do the best at shows.
Yeah,
so it's like, we gotta write
sure.
more. We gotta
yeah,
write more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And then it's like I said, I'm listening to 50 Cent.
Yeah.
Like I want to make a song with a chorus like that.
You're living the
and
rap
then,
dream.
And then I'm starting to hear my music. Like I'm trying too hard to try to make something that's like more mainstream, even though I can't do it. There's
right.
there's nothing I can do to make
right.
a mainstream song. It's always going to sound like underground grouch in some
yeah,
way.
Yeah, totally.
And I kind of knew that, but I still, like, you know,
that's always been my favorite part about the whole argument of like, oh, this ignorant pop rap. I'm like, yo, do you know how hard it is to write a pop rap song that
Man,
a million people love? Like,
I can't
that's
do it.
Impossible.
You know? So,
yeah, exactly. So, you're writing that kind of, you're trying to like write stuff
yeah.
a little more upbeat.
Yeah, yeah, that type of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But you guys settled the family differences.
Family difference, and then I was like, you know what? I'm done with this shit. I'm done with the like party rah rah, you know. And then I flipped it, and I almost like looking back on it, I almost flipped it too hard, but I didn't because that's what I needed to do. Like, you know, I cleaned my shit up. I was at that point, there was no living legend who could do a show sober. Mm. Like we were all getting fucked up. To do shows. And that's not how it started. I started as a guy who wanted a positive message.
Yeah.
I was completely sober. We were all like uplift, you know, positive hip hop. Cause that's what we learned from, you know, Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, Hyro. We wanted to push that positivity and fun.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so.
Was there a lot of internal conflicts at that time?
It started to be like ego battles, you know, why is the, you know, you guys are more popular in the group because you're white, you know, some of that was there.
I was always curious, like, that's the thing. This was a question that I tucked away earlier, but when you were saying like, oh, I was the white kid at these functions and didn't want to like step on any toes or didn't want anybody to think that I was there
right.
out of place. And I was always wondering if that ever flipped to where it was like, well, now you're the white guy that's popular. You know
well,
what I
yeah,
mean?
Because this underground rap turned like hip hop got to be the most popular form of music at some point. And then the audience starts infiltrating as white people. We're doing college shows.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I'm probably pinning some of my raps to, you know, to aim towards those people because these are the people who are showing up at the shows and I want to get a reaction from them.
And it's a business.
And I know the kind of I know, you know, if I say self-deprecating stuff, then this kind of audience is going to feel it, you know?
Right.
Or if I say, you know, but it was never my intention to make a white audience. For years, I was like, please.
Yeah.
More black people come like recognize us as legitimate hip hop too.
Yeah.
And that never happened.
And you can't help that.
And I can't help it and I can't be mad at it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know? But I love all people and I want everybody to love my music.
Right, right.
And
so there's some ego battles going on.
And then it's like I kind of, you know, all the party shit was like, I'm getting high fives for dealing with groupies and being fucked up and being a party man. So it's like when I stopped that, it was kind of like, yo, what's up with Grouch? He's weird now. You know, like,
was there like some always turning his back or something?
Yeah,
or?
In a way, because I just I kind of like cut that shit cold turkey. And I remember like,
was it hard?
It was very hard. I remember like having to be feeling like I'm going up against something just because I'm doing a sober show. And I'm like, and the way that I am, I presented it like that. Like I used it as a music, like I'm on stage now and I'm sober.
Yeah.
This is my first sober show. Please give me some love. I'm sober and I'm trying this shit and it's hard and I'm trying to face you guys.
Was it hard to kick the booze? too? Or you know what I mean? Did you have like a physical reaction to any of that? Was it at that point?
Not a physical reaction, but it was so ingrained. It was a habit. Yeah. It was like, it was pretty hard. But then once I did it, it wasn't. It's like, I was just over it. Yeah. I had like moved past it.
So is this around the time that you like up and moved to Hawaii?
No, not yet. This is around the time that I got my wife pregnant.
Okay.
Yeah. We went through this time.
Yeah.
And then we got pregnant.
Hey, mazel.
Which was probably like God stepping in.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And
so now you got this new life on your mind to take care of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, I only want to push shit that my family can be proud of.
Right.
You know? And then that's when I started. I had always had this relationship with Zion I from the Bay Area.
Right.
And they were like always good-hearted, positive people. And we had made a song together called Silly Putty that was very successful for both of our careers.
Right.
And so then we started our Zion I and the Grouch collaboration albums.
Right.
And I remember stopping doing a lot of Living Legends stuff at that time, and even music, period. I just remember when I got my wife pregnant, I just dropped everything and just focused on family and gardening and house. And, you know, I just remember like less phone, just I was living life, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, how am I going to pay the bills if I don't do enough music and business? But I wasn't scared, and I was like, fuck it, I'm just gonna do. And for some reason, even though I neglected everything business wise, like opportunity still came, and like I was supported by the universe in that way.
I was gonna say, to an extent, like living life is kind of the ultimate rap flex.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's like the ultimate power move.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So
yeah, that's tight.
So we had our daughter, we had her at home. I got on this whole kick. Like when my wife got pregnant, you know, immediately when the hospital finds out that you're pregnant, they bombard you and start sending you all this stuff about, you know,
appointments,
baby formulas, appointments at the hospital, all this unnatural shit they want you to sign up for. And I was like, yo, why am I getting hit? This is like I'm getting hit by businesses and companies and shit in my mailbox, and they're trying to get at my kid, and my kid's not even out of the womb yet.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And we were like, that hit me like, oh, that's nasty. You know? Like, what kind of business is this? And then, like, you know, someone told me about this movie called The Business of Birth or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we watched it, and it was all about how, you know, from the minute the woman goes into the hospital, they want to shoot her up with some sort of, you know, Pitocin to make things go faster. And then the woman doesn't want to feel pain, so they give her another shot. Basically makes your baby high off drugs, you know what I mean? Yeah. Your baby comes into the world in some, like, crazy state.
Yeah.
The woman is subdued. The connection to the baby is lost because they take the baby and they put them
in
another
room.
First
chemical reactions.
You know what I mean?
Right.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
So that led us on a journey, you know, and then they shoot up the baby with all the antibiotics or whatever, the vaccines and all that stuff. And this is a little tiny under 10 pound baby, you know, and it's not natural. So we got on this kick about what's natural, what's the best way to bring a baby into the world. We had our daughter in water naturally at home.
Yeah.
And then we just got on, you know, we got on this whole health kick and like, how should we be eating? And, you know, just this consciousness, spiritual vibe. And then at that point, it just didn't seem like the valley served us anymore.
Right.
And when my daughter was close to 2 years old, we had been going to Hawaii back and forth because we do shows over there.
Yeah.
And we also recorded a Living Legends album called Classic over there in Maui.
Right. Right.
And that place just always resonated with me and my wife.
It's so beautiful there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I would be in California, like eating dinner or washing dishes, just daydreaming about Maui. And one day I just got on the actually, my wife and I would go there for vacation every time it was time to go on a vacation.
Right.
And we said, well, we got to pick somebody somewhere else or else we're never going to see any more of the world, you know?
Right, right.
And so I got on the computer and, of course, like somehow I end up on this Hawaii, Maui, 6 month sublet. And, you know, it was like on this beautiful property in, you know, off the grid, you know, water from catchment, water from the rain and solar power and everything. And so we went and lived there for 6 months. And by the end of the 6 months, we were like, we cannot argue with how we feel. We have to live here.
How long have you been there now?
9 years.
You still out there?
Yes.
Where are you staying while you're here? Or just like hotels and stuff? Or no, like you're just here for a little bit?
My brother lives in Santa Monica.
I kind of like vaguely know your brother through the scene.
Brad.
Yeah, Brad, because he works for OF, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Good dude.
Very.
Yeah, for sure. So that's amazing. Yeah. What side of you live? Do you live like over by Hokipa?
I live in Kula.
Okay.
2,000 feet up the mountain, up the volcano Haleakala.
Okay, word.
And yeah.
The only time I've ever been to Maui, we were just talking about this. I was like on a photo shoot out there. We were shooting Ian Walsh, that big wave surfer.
Uh-huh.
And we were shooting him at a gym. And like, who walks up to the gym?
I saw you.
And I go,
yeah.
And I'm like, Corey? And you're like, yeah, hey, wait, I think I know you. And
yeah.
I was like, yeah, well, small world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So living in Hawaii, that seems like just fucking amazing, man.
Right.
Yeah. So life's good?
Yeah, life is good. The music went from that point that I told you, I did the Zion I Grouch stuff. And then I started concentrating more on Grouch and Eli.
Yeah.
We wanted to build that brand.
So does he fly out to work with you out there? How do you guys do that?
Sometimes he does that.
Yeah.
Most of the time, yeah. Everybody likes to come to Maui. So it's like, hey,
what a mystery.
I got an idea.
Yeah, right.
Let's make a new album in Maui.
Yeah,
Like anybody I work with thinks that they come up with this brilliant idea every time. And it's like... <They're>, you know,
that's
but
funny.
it's kind of crazy to make hip hop in Maui though. Like I had to learn, you know, I came from a little bit of struggle, nothing too crazy, but that's how I used to get my inspiration. Like I'm gonna show all these motherfuckers who are doubting me that I can make it, you know. And then, you know, when something goes wrong, I'm gonna write about it and get it off my chest. Now I live in Maui. I have a beautiful wife. I have a beautiful daughter. We stay in a gorgeous, you know,
what
place.
Are you supposed to complain about on record?
Yeah, I can't complain anymore. So I had to take this beauty and learn how to put it into hip hop that someone actually might want to listen to.
No, I find that so interesting because I was saying, like, you know, you look at Eminem's career and it's like once he got rich and he didn't have anything to fucking complain about and struggle, it's like it became unlistenable to an extent, certain records. And there's a real problem with like once rappers get comfortable, like what do you have left to rap about? And so, that's interesting that you've been able to take Maui and turn it into music because I feel like that would be hard.
But then some people are like, oh, I don't feel that.
Right.
You know? So it's like, and some people love it more, you know? So it's like some people only want to hear happy, positive stuff. Some people don't want to hear that. They want to hear, you know, and I don't know. I try to make what I feel.
Yeah.
You know?
What is life like? We'll wrap it up soon, but like, what is life like nowadays, an average day in the life of Grouch? What percent of time are you putting towards music today, or is it something where you go, I'm just going to spend 2 weeks doing it once a year, or you know what I mean?
I haven't been making music as much as I'd like to.
Right.
I always have the drive, the urge in my body to make it. But I also like living out there when it's beautiful outside and I look down and I can see the ocean and it's so nice and like it's calling me. It's like, get out of the house.
You gotta take advantage.
You can't stay in the house today,
right.
You know, and have headphones on and be in your garage because I still have just a humble garage studio.
Yeah.
but, you know, then I come home at night and I'm like, oh shit, that was a great day.
Right.
And then I feel like some creative juice and then I'll get on the thing and make a beat or, you know, actually I don't produce as much as I used to. But you know, and a day in the life of me is like waking up early in the morning, making my daughter lunch, driving her to school, dropping her off, coming back home, dealing with emails and whatever kind of business is going on, you know, artwork or something, figuring out the schedule for a couple hours. And then, you know, then maybe I'll either go to the beach or go for a waterfall hike, you know what I mean? And then come back and by that time, it's usually time to pick my daughter up again. Then I'll get my daughter and figure out something to do with her, work on homework with her, or take her to a swimming pool.
Yeah.
And then later on is when I usually try to hit the studio when I come home.
Yeah, for sure. You know? It seems like you've created a balanced adult rapper life, and that is commendable.
Yeah.
That's tight, man. And so then, like, once a year you do the big, like, Grouch and Eli, or the Grouch Who Stole Christmas tour.
Yeah, How the Grouch Stole Christmas.
How the Grouch, yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, no
and
problem.
And that's kind of like, that seems like a pretty fucking, that you could probably sustain a whole year off of that tour, I'm sure.
I make most of my money in the year off of that tour, but I cannot sustain a whole year on that.
Right.
Yeah, I wish I could.
Yeah, yeah. Close enough. But so what is next? That's coming up soon then.
I did that.
That's already done?
How the Grouch Stole Christmas. We did it early this year because initially when I created How the Grouch Stole Christmas, not that many people were touring in December.
Yeah.
And so we were killing it because the kids were coming home and they'd be at home for vacation and they'd be like, what are we going to do? You know, and
let's go see Grouch.
And the only answer was go see Grouch. And then everybody was like, let's do tours in December because that's when people don't tour.
Right.
It's like, man, it's so many people doing shit now. It's like it's gotten way harder.
It's a big market.
Yeah. Everybody's touring. Everybody thinks the way you make your money is touring.
Yeah.
So everybody's out there.
Well, but I mean, somewhere in the back of your head, you got to know that you guys helped create that mantra.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
part of it. You know, I mean, we contributed to it.
Yeah. People watched and learned from you guys. You know what I mean? And you guys had a lot of people that followed in your footsteps. And I don't know. I'm very grateful that you took the time to do this. This, like, to me, was this is a really interesting interview.
I had fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, man. And yeah, like, just thank you for all that musical output over the years, man. It meant a lot to a lot of people. So,
most definitely.
Yeah. Tell the people where they can find you online.
The Grouch on Instagram, therealgrouch.com, the Grouch on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm the Grouch on Twitter too.
There you go.
Yeah. But I'm trying to get off of that social media, but that's a really? Whole nother conversation.
It is. I'm kind of like vaguely off Instagram already.
Oh,
like
yeah?
I'm just kind of over it. I don't know why.
That's the only one that I kind of like because I feel some creativity
is
involved. That
one's got to be the easiest for you. That's a very photogenic place live, man.
True. Yeah.
But I still like tweeting because, I don't know, I like words and I don't write enough. So now I write in 140 characters, stupid sentences. But yeah, man, thank you. I appreciate it. He's one of these guys where you can just Google the Grouch and it'll pop up.
That works too.
Yeah, for sure. My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition and you can follow me at It's Intuition on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and whatever, all that shit. And then you follow us as a unit at Kinda Neat and go to youtube.com/kindaneat. And other than that, subscribe to the podcast. Go download that podcast app, search for Kinda Neat and subscribe. 5-star ratings. Leave a review. And that's it, man. Thank you for this long interview.
Thank you for having me, man.
Yeah, that was the Grouch. Yeah. I'm Intuition and that was Kinda Neat.
Cool. Thank you, dude. That was dope.